This is Jeremiah Tessier with Psychoanalytic Voices. Today, we are talking with Dr. John Madonna about his most recent book, Emotional Presence in Psychoanalysis, Theory and Clinical Applications. We talk a little bit about casework and a little bit about theory. I'm here with Dr. Madonna. Today, we'll be talking about emotional presence in psychoanalysis, theory and clinical applications. Hi, Dr. Madonna.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good. Why don't you introduce yourself for those who don't know you and those listening at home?
Okay, well, I'm Dr. John Madonna. I'm a licensed psychologist and psychoanalyst. I'm a faculty member here at the Boston Graduate School for Psychoanalysis. I've been here for many years working with students and faculty. And my book, Emotional Presence in Psychoanalysis, is the culmination of my many years of working with patients and with students and various other members of the community.
Why don't you just tell me about the book, whatever comes to mind, whatever you like about it.
Well, I like the cover. It's a very catchy cover, and I think it does convey the theme of the book, which is emotional presence in psychoanalysis. And the cover is two hands reaching mm-hmm. toward one another, and there's a flame of light just as the two index fingers are about to meet. And I think that sort of typifies the emotional experience of being able to achieve presence, emotional presence with another human being, which is very difficult to do. I mean, we spend a lifetime, a career, really trying to achieve that. And it's fairly well recognized that it is an important part of the healing process. Mm-hmm. And there's been quite a lot written about the therapy experience and being able to listen carefully to others and to be present to them. But there's so much within ourselves as people that make it difficult to do that. Mm-hmm. Transference, counter-transference reactions that we as therapists and analysts have, which interfere the patient's own resistance to relationship is operative. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've been thinking about that for many, many years and pondering and contemplating, you know, the intricacies of that. And that was the motive for writing the book, to try to bring some clarity to my own thinking with regard to that issue.
Mm-hmm. I think it really shows. When I'm reading the book, one of my favorite things about it is your honesty throughout it. And I connect that to this idea that in order to be emotionally present with someone else, you have to be emotionally present with yourself first. And what I mean by the honesty, you talk about people like Searles and their idea that the analyst being quiet and sort of retracted and doesn't say much or have much of a presence could be a defense to actually connecting emotionally with someone. And you mentioned a long time of contemplation, and it definitely shows in here. We have people like Bion or Bion, Winnicott, Searles, combined with the moderns. I guess something interesting or something important might be, how do you define emotional presence?
Well, we try to get to that in the book, both by definition and also by looking at how that occurs, doesn't occur at times in our work with patients. So, you know, emotional presence is really being able to be present to the patient regardless of the feeling they're having. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that we are always assuming the stance of a loving receptiveness. Mm-hmm. That's appropriate at times, but it's also being able to be receptive to the more difficult feelings, the aggressiveness, the mm-hmm. the anger, the hatred, the envy, the jealousy, all of those feelings as well that people bring with them, that they need to bring with them, that they need to present in their transferential experience with us and that we need to tolerate. And and it's not always easy to tolerate those feelings. So we're able to tolerate some types of those feelings better than others. But depending upon our own personal history, we may have difficulty with certain of those feelings. So it's a multi-dimensional effort that we make. We try to have good initial connection with people, connection that responds to their maturational level. Mm-hmm. You know, not everyone comes in a fully integrated, mature way. And so we need to understand that, and we need to respond to that appropriately. Mm-hmm. Their object relatedness. Sometimes people come, and I know we've all had this experience, whether we're analysts or not, where we're talking with someone. It might be a friend, it might be a family member, a coworker, and they're talking to us, and it's like we're not even there. Mm-hmm. They're really talking to themselves, or they're talking to some inner
idea
or object that they have going on. So we need to be able to be patient in the presence of that. There's a case in this book that where that happens with a very seriously disturbed man, in which he did not relate to me for many, many, many months and years, I would say. He was lost in his own fantasies. Whenever he would make a communication in my direction, it was really in response to his internal fantasy world. So I describe in that case how difficult it was after a while in the dark room, week after week. I began to become anesthetized. I began to become paralyzed emotionally. And the only thing that sustained me with that individual was my feeding off of his fantasy life, which was very florid and interesting. And I talk about how that case proceeded and how we were able eventually to move beyond that so that the patient was able to come into an emotional presence with me that was more realistic, more object-oriented. And so there is a difficulty to that, being able to tolerate certain aspects of that. Patients come sometimes looking for lots of affirmation and lots of love. And I talk about that in another case, another chapter here, entitled "Till Death Do Us Part," of a woman who was very dramatic in her need, who established a very positive transferential relationship with me. I could do no wrong. There was an erotic component to it. And that turned into a very a negative experience, in the sense that she knew I wasn't going to satisfy her her longings and needs in the way she wanted me to.
Was this the woman that you went on the walks with?
Yes. She happened to live in the area of my office, and I would often see her when I was out walking. She'd want to walk with me. I would allow her to do that for periods of time. She began to demand more, try to analyze that need, and but it was very frustrating for her, and I became the object of quite a lot of her hostility. There's no fury like that of a woman scorned, they say.
That's
true.
What they say.
Absolutely true. But after being together, and she had a marvelous capacity to have all of those feelings and to also step back from them and analyze them. She made tremendous gains over the years, but it was difficult. That was a difficult part of the treatment. It was not always easy to feel emotionally connected. I had moments when I wanted to kill her. She was so provocative. But that that was very refreshing for her, because she suffered from an obsessive compulsive disorder, classical in nature. She was constantly hand washing, sometimes with bleach, and she was trying to deal with the tremendous rage that she had toward her parents and family members and toward aspects of herself. Mm-hmm. And when I could talk in a garrulous and irreverent way, could voice my wish to kill her, throw her out the window of my office on one occasion, she laughed uproariously because I was really reflecting her own murderous impulses that she couldn't tolerate.
Yeah.
So it was really beneficial for her to see a scholarly looking guy who she had great desire for and fondness for and respect for behaving like a gutter snipe, essentially, mm-hmm. you know?
Even
worse than she.
Suited people who look very very well put and put together can have negative feelings and thoughts and have these...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a good example of what you said earlier about how emotional presence isn't just this sort of lovey-dovey kind of gratifying thing. It has to do with being where the patient is at. And in this case, it was emotional presence was through, sounds like some sort of aggression. Is this the same case where I think you mentioned this could be looked at as a countertransference enactment, but really it was a well-planned intervention? I think you mentioned that in there.
Well,
you kind of flirt the line between countertransference enactment and really bringing it back into the transference with containing it.
Yeah. What we try to do is be observant of what the patient is saying, doing, and evoking in us. So we are studying the patient, and we're also studying ourselves, and we don't come up with these interventions right away. Some of the interventions I made with her are not interventions that were made early. It was only after a really prolonged period of time. And it was based on my appreciation of what her tolerances would be for such interventions. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't tell a patient you're going to throw them out your window because you're feeling frustrated with them during the first 6 months of the treatment.
That's an enactment.
That's an enactment.
That would get rid of them.
Right. Yeah. That's unconscious in nature. It's impulsive. Mm-hmm. But it can be successfully conceptualized and executed when you get to know the person, given the circumstances of the moment, and appreciating as I came to appreciate with this person her really intense capacity to attack herself for these very feelings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to receive that from me enabled her to not just attack me, but to enjoy the fact that I could have those feelings too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm going to guess that the obsessive compulsive aspects of her died down after that. Was that to keep in something that she felt was out of control, or is that your idea?
In the beginning, it was very, very pervasive. Mm-hmm. You know, she came to my office on a very warm summer day.
Oh, I remember
that.
Initial
session, buttoned up.
All coats.
Opened the door of my office with a handkerchief, and was very concerned about being contaminated. Mm-hmm. Her whole life was structured around avoiding contamination. And she was able to work that through. The contamination was all about her own murderous impulses. She was very much like Lady Macbeth, you know, outspot. She really hated her parents and, you know, exerted some of the dialogue that went on in sessions, in which you get a sense for the visceralness of the hatred that she couldn't acknowledge prior to treatment. Mm-hmm. Yes, over the years she got to dissipate that. The symptomology disappeared for the most part. She was able to successfully retire. She was able to reconstruct her marriage. And and is living in a more relaxed state now.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
That's the goal.
Yeah. Okay. So I, you know, just to acknowledge the contributors in this book.
Okay.
There were a number of contributors who also wrote about this issue of how to attain emotional presence. And sometimes it's very nebulous, that whole process. Dr. Ted LaQuercia wrote an article about symbolic communication, in which he very interestingly described how, in a session with a patient, a very pleasant person who was very peaceful in his temperament came into session one day, and LaQuercia was just listening and not intervening very much, but had the image of a rifle, a gun, come to mind, and he pondered it and held on to it for a while. It seemed like an incongruent occurrence, unconnected to this type of personality that he was dealing with. And he introduced it. He asked the patient, "Why am I thinking about a gun right now?" And the patient, I think he gasped a bit and said, "How interesting you're thinking about that. I'm about ready to visit my brother, whom I haven't seen in a long time. He lives on the other side of the country. And I'm very nervous about it. When I was a child, my brother threw me out of a moving car, and I was almost killed. And my brother is someone who has lots of guns, and I want to see him, but I feel frightened. I have the old fear." And that led to more progressive communication and about information that LaQuercia had not had before. So it's sort of mystical in a way. You're sitting with a patient and you're getting a sensation, an image that doesn't seem to belong, but it's being transferred to us. And we have to pay attention to those things. So I think in that case, LaQuercia was really talking about that sort of meta-level communication that goes on when we are in a state of suspended animation, if you will.
Yeah, third year with Reich.
The third year with Reich. The other case that was also in that vein was by Gilligan.
Gilhooly,
I'm sorry.
I think his first name was Gilligan. But yeah, that was a great...
Gilhooly. A similar thing happened where he was with a person. Well, a number of things were happening in that case. This was a very tragic and sad case of a man, middle-aged man, whose son died of a tragic illness, and he was suffering tremendously and bringing all of that into the session, which can be not just arduous for the patient, but also for the therapist. You're bearing witness to one of life's great unfair tragedies, if you will. And so that was there, but Gilhooly was also stirred to remember his father's suicide.
Yes, I remember reading that and being very moved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And having to deal with all of that, and I believe they both had a dream together.
They did. They had a
very
similar dream.
They had a similar dream, and so what we see there is the sharing of psyches that goes on when we're receptive to others. And Freud began to get into this a little bit toward the end of his career, talking about the uncanny.
Yeah.
I think if he had had more time and he'd had more opportunity, we would have heard more from him about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get that sensation sometimes when I'll be going about my daily life and I'll get the thought of a person, and there was no preliminary thought about that person. That person will just come to mind. And frequently, a day or two or three days later, I'll get a call from that person.
Mm-hmm.
So there's sort of this... this connection, I think, that we have psychically with people, Jung.
Yeah, I was going to say Jung gets mentioned a few times in passing here, but this is very much like the work he did with synchronicity in that bit.
Exactly,
yeah.
And this sort of psychic archetypal
yeah.
root system that may be connecting us all, really.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fascinating, and it all constitutes, you know, certain aspects of our propensity, if you will, for emotional connection
mm-hmm.
with people, not just in the obvious ways, the verbally connected ways, but in just in terms of sensory and imagery that we might be subject to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the other contributors do similarly. Dr. Daniel Egan talks about the whole effort to attain emotional communication in resistant classrooms.
That was a great chapter.
And, yeah, that was a very good chapter. You know, not to spoil it for any potential readers, I think it is a book well worth reading because you really do get a sense for the challenge of this issue,
mm-hmm.
whether you're a therapist, a counselor, a teacher, an analyst. You know, we do have to achieve a resonant level of emotional communication,
mm-hmm.
which includes all of the feelings, not just the loving feelings, although love gets short shrifted frequently, especially in our being enthralled with the hostility that patients have.
Mm-hmm.
And it's awfully hard to see through that to a potentially loving moment, nor should we. I mean, we have to be where the patient is.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is how the unconscious works. You leave off on love, and that sets me up for a question I've been wanting to ask. Before I left to come here, I looked at my copy of, I think it's Love and Will by Rollo May. And he's a Sartrean. But I remember when I first bought the book at your book party, I flipped to the end. I always flip and look through the citations. And I saw, oh, he cited Jean-Paul Sartre and Martin Buber. And I thought, those are some interesting names to be in a sort of modern psychoanalytic book. So I was wondering, and there is sort of this existential thread, I feel, through the book. So where does your use of Sartre and Buber come into play? I know they only get mentioned once, but I'm a philosopher, so I'm very interested in those names.
Well, I haven't read much Sartre, but when I was studying at the master's level, I did study with some existentialists.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just fond of this I-thou notion
mm-hmm.
that Buber espouses, and Viktor Frankl and others, and just in the broadest sense, being ready for the encounter,
mm-hmm.
the phenomenological encounter with the other, unencumbered by too much theory. We have to have theory. We have to have lenses in order to understand the possibilities of an encounter.
Yep.
But we shouldn't be so wedded to it that it obstructs us from encountering the other in the I-thou sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that has always appealed to me. You know, I'm not suggesting that we don't pay attention to theory, but that we're judicious in our, we should understand theory and then suspend it.
Yes.
Each time we go into a session. And there was a relatively well-known Boston analyst who said we should enter each session without memory or desire, which is hard to do
mm-hmm.
because we enter these sessions induced with all kinds of feelings, and we enter with our own prejudices and biases, etc. But we should strive to enter each session without memory or desire so that we can encounter the person. And then memory and desire will emerge
mm-hmm.
as we proceed with the person, and then that's to be understood.
And the memories and desires that do emerge say something important about the
case. That's right,
yeah.
Exactly.
I think it that I and thou idea definitely cuts across all the articles and the idea of emotional presence. Is there anything you want to say that didn't get said about the book or any of this?
Well, I think the notion that that as analysts we are very well trained. I can only speak for the school that trained me and my colleagues here at the school and the students from whom I've learned a tremendous amount. I feel very well trained theoretically because of all of that. However, we're all just people beneath that, and we're all subject to the human impulses, desires, drives, etc., shortcomings, and we need to have a certain humility about our work, and we are, if we're doing our work well, we are rendered humble as we've proceeded through the years, because the pathology that that we get to work with and share in with our patients is sometimes immense, and it exceeds our ability at times to fathom and to always manage effectively. And it is in our ability to accept that we have the possibility of advancing and learning and being of use to the people that we're with.
Wonderfully put.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you doing this.
Absolutely.
It was a great experience.
Good.